There's been a major renaissance over the last few years in terms of Australian militarism and colonialism. We've seen Australian forces being deployed to an increasing number of countries, military spending is continually rising, and Australian officials are playing a direct role in the government of several neighbouring countries. Now, later on, we'll be talking about what is driving this worrying trend. I'm also going to try to point out some of the lessons to the left. But I thought for the first part of the talk, I'm going to actually look at some of the recent examples of Australian colonialism. So let's start with the troop deployments over the last 12 months. Firstly, there's the Solomon Islands. In May last year, almost 200 Australian military personnel and police were deployed to the Solomon Islands, and they joined the more than 2,000 mainly Australian police, bureaucrats and military officers that comprise RAMSI, the regional assistance mission to the Solomon Islands. RAMSI was set up in 2003, and through RAMSI, Australia has basically taken over all of the key posts of the government in the Solomon Islands, the courts, the military, the financial departments, so forth. And that's pretty typical of the kind of model, the kind of neo-colonial model that Canberra has adopted in the Southeast Asian Pacific. Now, a whole number of countries. Basically, what you have is Alexander Downer declaring countries like Fiji, Papua New Guinea, Timor, Nauru to be failing states, in his words. And then, before we had a chance to retort back, yeah, we were a failing excuse for a human being. He's managed to cajole and intimidate the local political elite into accepting an Australian takeover of most key aspects of their government. Now, the troop increases to the Solomon Islands last May was a further encroachment on the idea that people in that country should have the right to control their own fate. The extra troops were sent in an attempt to enforce the outcome of a crooked election that had brought Snyder Rennie to power. The Australian forces provoked rioting when they fired tear gas onto crowds in the capital of Honiara, and troops were pelted with rocks and bottles, and 13 Australian police vehicles were torched. In order to keep Rennie in power, the Australian forces did all they could, including arresting two MPs to prevent them from participating in a vote of no confidence in Rennie. But all of this interference, all of the lobbying and the intimidation carried out by the Australian officials failed. The motion got up and Rennie was replaced with Mansaya Sogavare. Then in September, Sogavare expelled the Australian High Commissioner, Patrick Cole, who was the main person who orchestrated the manoeuvres to keep Rennie in power. As you can imagine, that pretty much incensed Canberra. Australian forces since then have been doing all they can to bring down Sogavare. They started by raiding the offices of his immigration minister. When Sogavare complained about this, his own offices were raided. And I think a lot of his popularity amongst the people come from the fact that he's tried to, at least vocally, take a stand against Australian imperialism. And thus far, his downfall has eluded the Australian government. However, when you turn now to East Timor, you'll see that the Australian government has had success in achieving regime change. In June last year, the Australians deployed 1,400 troops to reinvade Timor. This was to save this fledgling democracy from the greatest threat it could possibly face, a democratically elected government. I don't know how they got one in the first place. I personally, ordered a commission into this, but really, you don't have to worry anymore. This issue has been taken care of. Basically, the whole point of the mission was to ouster Murray Alkatiri. And I think you can see the kind of hostility that Australia has had towards Alkatiri in the way that the editor of Rupert Murdoch's quality broadsheet, The Australian, referred to Alkatiri as heading the anti-Australian Mozambique clique. Now, Alkatiri spent time in exile in Mozambique when Mozambique was part of the Soviet bloc, or allied to the Soviet bloc. And the implication is he's an unrepentant Marxist, which I don't really believe. But as Victoria University academic Helen Hill said of Alkatiri, he's spoken out against the privatisation of electricity and has managed to get a single desk pharmaceutical store in spite of initial opposition from the World Bank. He hopes that a state-owned petroleum company, assisted by China, Malaysia and Brazil, will enable Timor to benefit more from its own oil and gas, in addition to the revenue it will raise from the area shared with Australia. The young intellectuals at the university praise Alkatiri's economic knowledge and his ability to defend Timor's interests against the likes of the World Bank and the Australian government over the Timor Sea issue. Now, I don't want to puff Alkatiri up, you know, some sort of a radical or anything. This is not what I think of him. But for the Australian government, there was no reason for them to accept a Timorese Prime Minister that had even an ounce of backbone. Not when you have the likes of José Ramos Horta to choose from. Now, Ramos Horta, he's a right-winger. He's on record as saying that foreign companies who invest in Timor should pay no tax. He long ago sold himself to Australian and US imperialism, and for this reason, he was a vocal supporter of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. And he even wrote letters to newspapers condemning the Spanish government for their decision in 2005 to withdraw troops from Iraq, which he called appeasing terrorists. So, he was installed as Prime Minister. Australian troops, of course, remain in Timor to this day, and you may have noticed over the last 5 weeks that the Australian troops were engaged in two separate fatal incidents. You know, that basically, the Australian Empire has resorted now on two instances recently directly to murdering people. Okay, now in December last year, Australia and New Zealand both sent troops and police to the Pacific island nation of Tonga. The reason for this was to quell pro-democracy demonstrations that had come up opposing the autocratic rule of King George Taupo V. So, you know, Howard not only props up the monarchy here in Australia, he's also willing to you know, help prop up autocratic monarchies elsewhere in the region. And, you know, all of this paints a picture of the kind of eventful year that the Australian Empire has had. If you go back then to the beginning of 2005, Australian police and bureaucrats were deployed to PNG, in the words of Alexander Downer, to address issues of law and order, justice, economic management, border control and transport security. PNG used to be a formal colony of Australia, and Downer's plan was to now turn it into a quasi-colony. Most of these forces ended up leaving PNG after the PNG Parliament refused to grant immunity from prosecution for the Australian forces. You know, the fact that Australian police weren't allowed to go around maiming, killing, cheating and stealing without ever having to face justice turns out to have been a deal-breaker. You know, I mean, they get away with that sort of thing here. Why shouldn't they be able to do it abroad as well? Now, these numerous instances of regional interference by Australia are occurring simultaneously with Australia's commitment to America's brutal and failing wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. You know, you hear John Howard making announcements on a very regular basis nowadays to increase commitments to both of those wars. And in the case of Afghanistan, this policy has bipartisan support. So, for that matter, does the really stark upward trend in military spending, you know, which again is set to rise, you know, based on this week's announcements to over $30 billion. So overall, and on many fronts, there has really been a major ramping up of Australian militarism. And in part, this has been involved in assisting America's imperialist mission in Central Asia and the Middle East. But also, quite clearly, Australia is involved in a far more vigorous projection of its own power in this local region. Now, what I've described to you is the behaviour of an imperialist nation. Australia is an imperialist country in its own right, and there's nothing new about this. Australian imperialism goes back well before one John Winston Howard ever came onto the scene. Imperialism refers to a process that's typical and indispensable part of developed capitalism. It's the convergence of interests of capitalist enterprises, capitalist businesses, and the state. Basically, the large corporations of every powerful country rely on their government to intervene into the affairs of other countries on their behalf. Now, this is done for a range of reasons, to provide access to raw materials such as oil, to prize open access to markets, to ensure favourable terms of trade, to protect foreign investments and so on. A lot of this doesn't involve direct violence. It involves, you know, diplomacy, negotiations, all of that kind of polite stuff. But the ultimate arbiter of the power of nations is force. This makes war inevitable under capitalism. And I think it also explains why Australian imperialism's drive to play a greater controlling role in the internal politics and the economies of the countries to our north is necessarily tied in with an increase in military spending. These two things have to happen. Now, most people who are familiar with the term imperialism really wouldn't object at all to applying it to the United States. Most people recognise the United States intervenes in other people's countries, topples governments, wages war, bullies countries, invades other countries for the interests of American power and the interests of American corporations. Pretty uncontroversial nowadays. But I think that there is, unfortunately, paucity of recognition amongst anyone really in Australia that the Australian government does the same in this region. Australia is not a world power like the United States. It can't aspire to be. But Australia is a very significant power in this region. It's a significant military power. If you compare the military budget of Australia with Indonesia, there's really no comparison. Far more than double, and the gap is increasing. And obviously you're going to compare that to the military of the Papua New Guinea or Tonga. There's not really much of a race in it. And I think as well, Australian corporations, the large Australian corporations, are very large indeed. Australian multinationals of the likes of BHP Billiton, Telstra, National Australia Bank, these are comparable to the economies of Indonesia, Thailand and Malaysia. They certainly dwarf that of Fiji, Papua New Guinea or any of these places. Australia accounts for between 35 and 45% of bilateral trade with Fiji, and half of PNG's economy is owned by Australian corporations. Now, to be able to rule this region, Australia has always required the backing of a great and powerful friend. If you look back in history, this was always the mother country, Great Britain, and this explains policy back in the day, when even before Federation, Australia sent troops to the Sudan War in 1883, sent troops to the Boer War in 1901, and probably most famously World War One, when we had a Labor Prime Minister, Andrew Fisher, pledge that Australia would fight for the interests of the British Empire down to the last man and the last shilling. Now, after World War II, the US replaces Britain as the world superpower. And basically, Australia's orientation is basically what it used to be to Britain, except now they're orienting to Washington. Basically, the same type of policy goes on. Australia begged to be invited into Vietnam, contrary to the still pervasive myth that Australia was bullied against its own interests into intervening in Vietnam. Australia begged the bloody Whitlam Labor government begged to have the Pine Gap spy base built in Central Australia. You still have Kevin Rudd and Peter Garrett falling over themselves to get more Australian US bases built on Australian soil. And I think that Australia's involvement in America's wars today in Iraq and Afghanistan are very much tied in with Australia's desire not to control those parts of the world. That's not really what it's about, but as a way of ensuring or guaranteeing Australia's control over the countries more directly to our north. What Australia's doing is proving to the United States, the world superpower, that yes, we are a reliable ally. You can entrust us to perform the role of a deputy sheriff in this region. Okay, so what's motivating Australian imperialism? What are they trying to do? And there's sort of two overarching goals, I think. The first is stability, what they call stability, and the second is trying to achieve a competitive advantage over their rivals. And of course, in each specific instance, more sort of specific, localised issues, often to do with the interests of this and that corporation. But I think you have to see that this isn't the fundamental way that imperialism works. Imperialism isn't just, a company makes a request for you to go rip off some particular resource and send in the troops. That does happen, but there's always, a grander strategic game at play. And I think the two key things that they're concerned about are local stability, and the second is to lock out competitor nations. Okay, so firstly, in relation to stability, Australian commentators refer all the time to the arc of instability to our north. Basically, they feel like a lot of these countries are prone to a range of crisis situations. You know, popular revolts, military takeovers, secessionist movements demanding national liberation, and so on. Now, Australia wants to either clamp down on as much of this activity as possible, or to make the running in determining the outcome of the flux that's taking place in the region. Thank you. Now, none of this has anything to do with humanitarian aims, protecting democracy, preventing bloodshed, or any of this rubbish. None of it. You know, you take the example of the Solomon's Tonga and the 2006 Timor intervention, if you think Australia is vaguely concerned with democracy. I think the question of bloodshed, you know, the idea that Australia wants to prevent bloodshed, this is absolute crap. You know, Australia, part of the whole goal of stability is to stabilise the Indonesian archipelago. You know, the territorial integrity of Indonesia. They've always seen this as a key goal because they want to protect the vital sea lanes, in that area. So they want to keep Indonesia together. So basically, they have given a permanent green light. Canberra's given a permanent green light for the Indonesian government to basically, you know, massacre the secessionist movement in Aceh, you know, for instance. And it was the same policy that drove Australia to support for almost a quarter of a century, you know, stabilising East Timor by drowning that nation in blood. You know, Australia always backed that because that was stability to them. Indonesia helping us, you know, we're going to help the Indonesians stabilise. That's what that's about. And the other thing that I said is locking out competitor nations. A few months back, John Howard explained his interventionist policy in the Pacific to the Daily Telegraph, and this is what he said. If we throw up our arms and go away, you'll end up with these places being taken over by interests very hostile to Australia. And I think the main force he's worried about is China. The largest Pacific island economy, PNG, has increased its aid with China from $5 million in 1991 to $540 million in 2005. And as I said earlier, you know, competition between the rich and powerful countries, that really is the heart of imperialism. I think that is also important in explaining the stance of the ALP, because the ALP has supported every single military intervention in the Asia-Pacific region in the Howard years, supported unquestioningly most of the time. They attack Howard from the right, saying, why didn't you send the bloody troops earlier? Now, this is absolutely constant, you know, across-the-board support by the Australian Labor Party. I think you've got to understand, the Labor Party is committed to the profitability and the success of Australian business, as Kevin Rudd is so eager to explain to anybody who'll listen. And Australian, I think, part of the important thing to get your head around this. The Australian ruling class is absolutely unanimous about this imperialist drive in the Asia-Pacific region, absolutely unanimous about it. I think we've got to draw a bit of a comparison between their attitude to this and their attitude to the war in Iraq. You see, I think that there were sections of the Australian ruling class who wanted to be a bit more discerning about how Australia assists the American empire. All the Australian ruling class is committed to the US-Australia alliance. They all want that alliance. There's no question about that. Some of them were a bit more discerning. They thought the Iraq war might not be the right way to go. And certainly now the war is a complete disaster, completely unwinnable. Some of them are thinking maybe it's time to withdraw from Iraq. So, of course, there are those who still say all the way with Bush, but there's a division there. But it opens up a space for Kevin Rudd to say, less troops in Iraq, more troops in Afghanistan. That's a good way that's a reasonable enough way for them to assist American imperialism and maintain their alliance. I think there is absolutely no division in the Australian ruling class over the question of the Solomons, Timor, PNG, and all of these interventions. There's none whatsoever. So I think we can expect that if a Rudd Labor government comes into existence this year, that none of these policies that I've outlined are going to change in the slightest. Absolutely certain to continue. Now let's look back at the events. I'll look back now at the event that really started all of this. Really started, you know, the renaissance of Australian colonialism, and that's the events in East Timor in 1999. This was the year when Australian troops first took over that country. And I think that event played a similar role. The massacres that happened after the Timorese voted for independence, I think that event played a similar role to the September 11 attacks for American imperialism. There's this invigoration after September 11 of American imperial aggression. I think the issue of Timor and the massacres in Timor played a similar role in providing a pretext for a more aggressive Australian imperialism. I think the other reason why these events are worth looking at a bit as well is that when Socialist Alternative opposed the Australian intervention in 1999, this was highly controversial. In fact, we were utterly isolated. Now, okay, it's 8 years on, and I think now is the time to draw up a balance sheet of this issue. In terms of East Timor, Australian imperialism has a terrible, terrible record. When Indonesia invaded in 75, the Whitlam government, Australia's government, was the first in the world to recognise Timor as a legitimate possession of Indonesia. For the next 24 years, they supported Indonesia, not just diplomatically, but arguing to anyone who'd listen that Timor should not have independence, but also in a practical way, providing military training, providing weaponry. And this was even after the scandal of the 1991 Dili massacre. They always supported this. And I think to understand why, the words of Paul Kelly, the editor of the Australian newspaper, I think is highly illuminating on the attitude of the Australian elite to the question of Timor. He wants to rupture the fairy tale view that Australians have had of the question of Timor. The real reason Indonesia invaded East Timor 31 years ago is because Jakarta had no faith whatsoever that an independent East Timor in 1975 would be anything other than a divided, unstable, pro-Marxist entity, chronically weak after a brief civil war, yet resistant to Indonesian leverage and susceptible to penetration by other powers in an Asia where Vietnam had fallen to communism 6 months earlier. Kelly then goes on to deny that this is a justification for the Indonesian invasion and subsequent brutality, but it nonetheless clearly indicates why the Australian government and political establishment did precisely condone and actively support the Indonesian occupation. They were worried about regional stability, they were worried about their rivals. Then in 1998, Suharto dictatorship falls in Indonesia, overthrown by popular rebellion in the midst of a crisis, an economic and political crisis. And it's due to this crisis that Indonesia decides it can no longer hold out in East Timor. They agree to allow the East Timorese to have a ballot to decide whether they want to have independence, and not surprisingly, the Timorese vote to do just that. What follows for the next few weeks is massacres and looting in Timor. More than 1,000 people were killed. Now, this caused a massive scandal in Australia because there was quite a long-running and high-profile campaign in solidarity with East Timor, very well entrenched in on the campuses, very well entrenched in the trade unions. And basically, this was dominating the news. Your TV programs were interrupted all the time to give you the latest reports from Timor. You had large demonstrations, particularly in Melbourne, where they were led by Trades Hall Council. There were calls to boycott Garuda and other Garuda Airlines and other Indonesian businesses. There really is massive sentiment. Quite rightly so. Disgust at what the pro-Jakarta forces were doing to the Timorese. The problem was that this movement as a whole was calling for troops to go in. So basically, what had happened in Timor was the Indonesians had figured out they can't stick it out in Timor any longer. There was no chance of this. But they wanted to send a signal to the Archonese and the West Papuans that if they press ahead with their demands for independence, they can expect nothing but terror and bloodshed. Now, Australia agrees with that message, doesn't it? It doesn't want to break up the territorial integrity of Indonesia. So basically, these massacres continued until both Jakarta and Canberra were satisfied. All the while, it was the Australian left demanding that troops go in, saying Australian military is needed. And after Canberra and Jakarta were happy the massacres had sent their message, they sent the troops in. Okay. Beauty. All right. Now, we, on the other hand, stood up to this barrage and told the truth. 3 months before the invasion, Tom Bramble, right here, argued in Socialist Alternative magazine that the occupation of East Timor by UN forces would make Australia the kingmaker in deciding who should rule in East Timor on the UN's departure. And it would result in East Timor becoming an Australian neo-colony. He also argued that such an intervention would provide a pretext for increasing the Australian military budget, and it would make it easier for Australian forces to be deployed against the peoples of the region in the future. But we were right on these questions, as we proved in spades on every one of these questions. Now, firstly, there can be no doubt that Australia considers East Timor to be, you know, a colonial property, that Australia should have the right to intervene and determine the nature of internal politics of East Timor. No doubt whatsoever. The overthrow of the Akatiri regime proves that. Another key indication of Australia's domination of Timor is the way that this desperately poor country was pressured to hand over large amounts of its potential oil revenue to Australia. The oil and gas deposits in the Timor Sea are worth over $10 billion. In 2002, Australia withdraws from the international courts to settle maritime border disputes. Because under these laws, under international law, East Timor was entitled to 100% of the revenue in the Timor Sea. 2 years ago, Australia accepts, or the Timorese accept a very generous deal from Australia to give the Timorese 50% of that revenue to which they are entitled, on the condition that the oil and gas is refined in Darwin, so no jobs for the Timorese. Secondly, in relation to arms spending, within a year of the 1999 invasion of Timor, the notorious Defence White Paper is released. And this predicts that over the next 10 years, Australian military spending will rise to $23.5 billion. Well, if you read the bloody paper in the last week, it's already increasing to $30 billion. And, you know, John Howard quite clearly linked the question of Timor to this increase in funds. You know, at the launch of the White Paper, he had this to say: heightened public interest in the military in the wake of the East Timor deployment and the natural pride that Australians felt in the professionalism and success of that operation. He gloated over this. And, like last year, it was the sixth time that, you know, that they exceeded Defence White Paper spending. This coming budget's going to be the seventh one. They've exceeded the Defence White Paper, our targets. And last year was the first year for decades the amount that the federal government spent on the military exceeded that they spent on education. You were proven right on that one. And finally, in terms of giving legitimacy to Australian forces to intervene elsewhere, I've given you the bloody examples of the Solomons, PNG, Tonga, and all the rest of it. And, again, the ruling class are pretty savvy about this. They know... they know the role that the whole Timor intervention played in giving an ideological justification. So the Financial Review wrote in 1999, the calls for action in Timor were ironic, because many of those who had fostered the political climate in which the army was run down were the loudest in demanding that Australia intervene there. This call to arms has, for the first time in decades, given broad legitimacy to the proposition that Australia should be able to intervene militarily outside its territory. And that's interesting. First time in decades. I reckon the time he's referring to was the Vietnam War, wasn't it? People were sick of Australian military intervening in Asia after, the horrors of the Vietnam War. Well, now it's very much back on the agenda. And I think that the groups, I think we should bloody name them. It was the Labor Party, especially the Labor left, the entire union bureaucracy, the Greens, and certain socialist groups, and I'll particularly mention the DSP, the Democratic Socialist Party, as they were known then, or Democratic Socialist Perspective, who you may know from their youth wing resistance, the Socialist Alliance organisation that they run, and its paper Green Left Weekly. They were basically the most hawkish of all in demanding Australia go in 1999. And these people are basically unrepentant. The DSP still proclaims the left's leadership over Timor. And the Greens, not only do they not apologise for what they did in 1999, they continue this in relation to every other one of these interventions. In 2003, when Australia went into the Solomons, Bob Brown had this to say: we have maintained that we need to be putting much more into the security in our neighbourhood. The Solomon Islands have been festering away without the government acting on it, and it's acting now, and that's to be welcomed. Okay, so the key point I think to get out of this, the key point to get out of this is that under no circumstances should we view the Australian military as a force that can improve the situation of any country. The Australian state is an imperialist menace that is only capable of acting in the interest of Australian big business. You know, 6 years after Australia, 7 years after Australia liberated East Timor, you have this report from the Focus on the Global South, which noted that November to March every year is referred to as hunger season. That's what it's like. You know, we're the richest country in the region, and we liberated this country, and this is the conditions that we've requested to them. Yet Australian policy has not been to provide, say, large sums of unconditional aid, not even, half a percent of Australia's military budget. Not even that. No. What has Australia's policy been? It has been to assure that Asia's poorest nation gets the least amount possible from its oil revenue. Now, that's been their policy. That is Australian humanitarianism. That's a humanitarian intervention. Okay, to sum up, Walter Rodney, the great African scholar and activist, in his classic work, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, had this to say about colonialism in Africa. Faced with evidence of European exploitation of Africa, many bourgeois writers would concede, at least partially, that colonialism was a system which functioned well in the interests of European powers. However, they would urge that another issue is to be resolved, that is, how much the Europeans did for the Africans, that it is necessary to draw up a balance sheet of colonialism. And on that balance sheet, they place the credits and the debits. And quite often, they conclude that the good outweigh the bad. Now, this particular conclusion can quite easily be challenged, but attention should also be drawn to that process of reasoning, because that process of reasoning is misleading itself. The reasoning has a somewhat sentimental persuasiveness. It appeals to the common sentiment that, after all, there must be two sides to a thing. The argument suggests that, on the one hand, there was exploitation and oppression, but on the other hand, colonial governments did much for the benefit of Africans. They developed Africa. It is our contention that this is completely false. Colonialism had one hand. It was a one-armed bandit. And throughout his book, Rodney shows, all the justifications for colonialism in Africa were a million miles away from the reality of what took place. In a typically patronising and racist way, the British used to argue that they're bringing progress and enlightenment to the poor, backward, uneducated Africans. Rodney then shows that for the first quarter century of British colonialism in Africa, not a single African doctor graduated. And if you think the colonial invasions, based on outright lies, were something that only happened in the 19th century, you might want to think about the Iraq War in 2003. WMDs, anybody? The fact they're willing to put forward the preposterous contention that the mortal enemies, Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden, were actually in league with each other, they're going to suggest that they're bringing freedom and democracy. This is not a 19th century thing. This is always what happens with these sorts of colonial policies. No imperialist power ever tells the truth. None of them say, we're going to send you working class soldiers off to fight, to maim and kill, and quite possibly get blown up and die, so that we, your rich rulers, can be richer and more powerful. They have never made this argument. They always use excuses, whether it was, white man's burden, we're fighting for democracy, and nowadays, of course, you have humanitarian interventions. We're intervening for humanitarian purposes. This is the kind of stuff that you hear. And I think we have to reject all of this. We have to reject all of these excuses. We have to explain what those interventions are really about. And I think it's not just colonial projects either. Colonisation is only one of the strings in the bow of imperialism. There are different forms of colonialism, settler colonialism, established Australia, Canada, US, Israel. Sometimes, a democratic government like they have in Iraq, but backed up by, 180,000 troops. Okay, they oppose all of those. That goes without question. But imperialism has other ways of brutalising countries. You know, I was told Australian imperialism goes back a long way before Howard. In 1989, we had a Labor government that basically ensured the drowning in blood of Bougainville's campaign for independence. Because there was an Australian copper mine owned by CRA. They didn't colonise the country. They certainly gave the PNG government helicopter gunships and all the support it needed to put down that rebellion. Pose that as well. And impose other imperialist tactics, like the sanctions on Iraq before they colonised it this time. You know, a million people died in that. Whatever policies the imperialists have, we have to oppose it. So what I'm arguing for is anti-imperialist politics. And you'll notice that it's a very different kind of politics to the politics of the ALP and the Greens. Imperialism cannot solve the problems of humanity. Because imperialism is the problem that faces humanity. I want to say one final thing to conclude about having anti-imperialist politics. You do not have anti-imperialist politics unless you oppose the imperialist interventions of your own ruling class, of your own government. That's the benchmark. It's not good enough to say, oh yeah, the British Empire back in the day, they did some bad things, or I don't like what the Americans are doing. If you live in another imperialist country, your first obligation is to impose the imperialist policies of your own government, and to do so consistently. And I think that whether the excuse is, you know, white man's burden, humanitarianism, you know, defending democracy or whatever, anti-imperialists have to reject them all, and this is especially true in relation to the imperialism of your own ruling class. Really, the key thing the socialists have to do is oppose Australian imperialism. I think otherwise, all you end up doing is providing a smokescreen for Canberra's imperialist adventures, making it easier for them to use taxpayer money to dominate other peoples, steal their resources. And I, for one, do not believe that there is anything humanitarian about that.